Live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,654 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Wednesday, and Wednesday usually means interview day, and today, Wednesday means interview day. You know, we have talked about the transition from employment to entrepreneurship via the side hustle almost since this show began, because honestly, that's how the show began. I actually owned a company, but I really didn't want to work there anymore. Imagine that. And started this podcast in my car, for those that are new around here, back in 2008. Well, that makes me an old man. And I did that for about 18 months and then sold out my interest in my several companies that I was part of at the time and went to do this full time. So that transition we've talked about. But what we haven't really talked about is doing it in a big way, or maybe even doing it perpetually. I'm not sure actually what's going on with our guest Nate today, whether he plans on continuing this way for a long time, because it sounds like he's actually built his business to not need him that much while he still has a job. And there are certain things, I'm sure as we get into it today, that are really nice about having employment, i.e. W-2, I own the company, but still like the company's paying things like matching SSI and benefits, and having a big side income, which, you know, I had that for about a year here. And it was a little hard to walk away from, except, you know, depends on what you want to do with your business in your life. So we'll talk about those transitions, finding a niche, finding customers, and how to do this in a big way. How big? Like a 500K way, right? Building a business up to a 500K business while you still work a W-2 job. Is it possible? We're going to talk to Nate. We're going to grill him. We're going to find out, yo, bro, what are you doing and how are you doing it? And we'll ask all the questions. And if you have questions, you know what you need to do. If you are in the live feed right now, put the word question in all caps and then give me your question. Give me your question in a single sentence so we know what the hell you're asking, and so do you. And then if you want to give us details, do it after that. We will get Nate on in just a minute and get into it. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is, who is it? It is Above Phone. Above Phone is the way you can have your own private ecosystem for all the apps on your phone. You can have a phone that doesn't spy on you, that doesn't let your carrier spy on you, that doesn't let the app maker spy on you, that doesn't let the government spy on you. And there's a lot of other options too, including the Above Book, which is a great way to take your privacy back with your desktop applications. And, you know, when I had Hakeem on last week from Above Phone, they had a special going, and it was only supposed to be 2 days. It looks like they extended it. It's still running. So for the next 4 days, you can still get 10% off if you buy two devices. That could be two phones, two Above Books, one of each, and get that 10% off. And if you're an MSB member, you still get the $75 off the Above Phone, and you can stack the discounts. Because I asked Hakeem, and he said, yeah, sure, you can do that. So if you have a problem getting that done, you let me know, and I'll talk to Hakeem, and we'll get it done. But check out Above Phone and take back your privacy. Next up today is Joel Riles with K9 Academy. That is an offshoot of Fortress K9, where Joel breeds and trains some of the best protection dogs in the business. But as he was doing that, he had a lot of people that maybe couldn't afford a 2-year-old fully trained dog, wanted to take on the training themselves, or they didn't really want a protection dog. They wanted a homestead dog, or they wanted a hunting dog, or they just wanted a dog that didn't jack stuff up inside the house. So he developed K9Academy.us. He did that in conjunction with me. We worked on this together a couple of years ago when he brought me my dog, Belle, Belgian Malinois German Shepherd Cross. She's a wonderful dog from Fortress K9. But you can find all the courses at K9Academy.us. Check it out today, K9Academy.us, and know this. There is a course called the Problem Solving Library. It is completely free. That way you can decide if this is right for you. And I recommend everybody consider at least the basics course. You take that basics course, you learn how to train yourself to train your dog, those basic core obedience things, and you can take that dog anywhere from there. I know it seems overly simplified, but it really isn't. With that, let's bring our special guest on. Again, we're just going to call him Nate today, and he is anonymous for a very good reason. We actually had somebody come on and talk about doing things like this in the past, and it did get back to their employer, and they did lose their job. So we're not going to let that happen to Nate. With that, I want to say, Nate, welcome to the Survival Podcast, man.
Hey, Jack. I'm excited to be here. Been a long-time listener since way back in the Jetta.
Glad to have you with us, man. Hey, can we start off with, I know you don't want to give away exactly who you are, but can you give us a little bit of your background story, like at least the industry you're in professionally and, you know, how you got into that and what made you decide to build something of your own?
Yeah, so I've been in the equipment world for a long time, so in the rental industry. And with that, we've always been selling parts and selling equipment to these construction companies, and that's kind of where I cut my teeth on. That's where I've always that's where I kind of got my first experience in the industry, and that's kind of where I started to see a hole in the world that I live in and wanted to build a business in.
Okay, that's interesting. So you have a full time job, you haven't left yet. And you're building this side business, and here in your industry, I start to make some connections with the volume of money in this to a degree, but you could be outside that industry, I don't know. But how do you build a business while working full-time? And I guess there's more than one way to answer that question. So when I say how do you, I mean how does Nate build a business while working full-time?
Yeah, I'll be the first to say it's not easy. A lot of early mornings and a lot of long nights. And I remember way back when, you know, like when you were saying, you know, how you started the Survival Podcast, you know, you wake up early and you put in some time and you kind of just have to slog through it. You know, the first few years were really difficult. You know, then I'll hate to say those first few years didn't really have a lot to show for it. And then all of a sudden it seems like we really started to hit started to hit rocket fuel, and then we kept going.
And how are you? I mean, but how? Like, I mean, can you tell us something about the business that you've built? You know, what it does or what it delivers, and then the mechanics of how you made this work.
Yeah, for sure. So we're in the parts industry. So we sell parts for big earth moving equipment. And so the earth moving equipment, for anyone who isn't aware, they're expensive and parts are expensive. And dealing with the equipment companies, you know, like Cat, Case, you know, any of those big guys out there, you know, they're hard to deal with and people don't really want to deal with them. And lead times are long. And to be fair, there's a lot of open space. And that's kind of where we started to cut our teeth. And that's where we saw a hole in the market. So maybe answering your question in a little bit of a different way, how do we do it? You know, I started looking around and the parts that we sell, there wasn't an online store for them. So I built an online store. So anybody can come right online and buy the parts that they want. And they can just, you know, check out online and move on with their life versus having to call 12 different equipment companies, get one quote from 12 different people because no one ever gets back to you. And it started to really roll. And that's how we've really started to get some steam here.
And I actually kind of have a background in this space because I, for a while, worked in the outside plant construction market. We did directional boring, vibe plows, lots of work with excavators and backhoes and stuff like that. So I know what you're saying. The stuff's really expensive. And like we were in a really hot part of the market. This was like the 1990s and everybody was laying fiber optic cable all over Dallas Fort Worth. So we had active reps constantly visiting us from like Vermeer and Ditch Witch as an example. But I just say they were really proud of their parts. And I had a feeling that their margins were excessive. And so is that maybe part of the angle too, that by, you know, not paying a guy to run around and talk to people out in the streets or whatever, the guy just knows I need new teeth for this drill bit, or I need, you know, a new bucket for this excavator. I know what I need. I just want to buy it. And then maybe you can actually lower your margin a bit. Customer gets a little bit better of a price and no hassle. Is that kind of the value prop?
Yeah, for sure. So that's been a big difference for our customers is, you know, versus, you know, any Joe Schmo off the street, is that they can go right online. They know what they need. You know, they can punch in a part number on our website And we've kind of built like a Napa or Advance Auto type setup. And we can actually just fulfill their order. We built a good network of companies we deal with and just get it to them quick and easy. And yeah, we obviously were less expensive than the OEMs, but we still make healthy margins. And that's how we were able to scale this business to the size that we have. And obviously that's my first bit of advice for anybody who's wanting to actually get into a business is sell something expensive. Don't sell an $8, item or, anybody in the homesteading space, don't sell an $8 jar of beeswax or something small. Sell something expensive. Sell something that's $800.
Yeah. And just for folks, as we continue through here, I Nate and I seem to have some sort of a latency issue going on. It wasn't there in our pre-show talk. It's not affecting the audio quality, so we'll deal with it. But when I quit and you're waiting for him to answer, I figured it out now. It's about 4.5-5 seconds. It'll all be good. Just wait. When I boot the audio, I can pull those long pauses out real easy. I'm not sure why that's happening. But I'm with you on the sell something expensive thing. Like another thing that goes back to heavy equipment, that was actually – I used to do a lot of basically arbitrage online when Google AdSense actually paid decent money. So people would have a website and then they would have ads on it. And if somebody came to your site, didn't buy from you, click that ad, you still made a little bit of money. And one of my best paying niches is I built little micro sites about heavy equipment because just the clicks for some of that stuff was $5, $6, $7, which meant that Google was probably getting, $14, $15 just for the advertiser to advertise that equipment. Because it is so expensive, there's a lot of money in it. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And I would say even like if you're going to be in like the beeswax business, that's probably tough, but you'd be better off selling it by the case to somebody than selling it individually from a pure business standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. You want some amount of scale and some amount of actual commerce there. You want people who are going to buy some kind of quantity. People are going to come back and buy repeatable things. Consumables are really great. And that's where we really cut our teeth. And that's where people keep coming back to us at.
Yeah, I think in your space, and for those that didn't catch the first part, I'll put a link after this is all over so you can find it. But, Nate is in the heavy equipment industry, and I think a lot of people don't realize there's a lot of stuff on heavy equipment that does wear out, break down over time. Besides, like, it's not just putting an engine in. Like, there's certain components and parts. When I was in the underground business, and we did a lot of directional boring, for instance, the teeth on the drill bits. Like, those are actually pretty friggin' expensive. And they're really, in the limestone rock around here, there's no other option. But every so often, we'd have to pop those teeth out. Even if the drill head was still good, those teeth had to be replaced. And there's probably a ton of stuff in the world of excavators, earth-moving equipment, dozers, et cetera, like that, that you have, like, as an owner or an operator leasing, you have to replace those parts frequently.
Yeah, and what we've done really good on is seal kits. So that's where it's really good. Instead of replacing one seal, most companies, don't offer one individual seal to buy, and we occasionally will do that. But the majority of people say, okay, well, I'm just going to replace all the seals while I'm in here. If I'm rebuilding a hydraulic cylinder or any other kind of big piece of equipment, there's no reason to reuse seals. I mean, and that, again, that's a great, I think you taught me the term way back when, the ARPU, That's one way to bring that up. Instead of selling one $3 seal, you sell a $300 kit.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's for those that are not initiated with terms like ARPU. That's the average revenue per unit or average revenue per user. If you're more in the service software business, either way, like what is the average sale value, right? And that average sales price and your average COGS, which are your cost of goods sold, there's your average profit per sale. And what Nate's saying is that no matter what your margin is, you need a good one or you're going to go out of business. But no matter what your margin is, if the underlying unit sells for more, then you make more money per transaction, and that makes life a lot easier when you're trying to build, a multi-six-figure business. You mentioned something in your notes here about scaling to replace yourself, and you also mentioned virtual assistants. I have a feeling those two things go together.
They sure do. Man, you're on it. Yeah, so that's exactly it. So as anyone can imagine, when you're working full-time, you can't work another job or, work another business while you're working full time. So that was what I had to do. And honestly, it was a blessing in disguise way back when. when I had to figure this out early. So, you know, any company that gets big enough, you know, they make their own systems, they build processes, they do all these things that, you know, the customers get what they need, they get taken care of. And I had to do that right from the get-go, you know, so me just starting out, you know, trying to learn anything and everything, you know, I had to figure out how to get an order out the door, how to make sure the customers were handled, how did they get calls back? And that's what I learned, you know, way early on. And, you know, you have to, one of the big things we did from the very beginning was, create SOPs. And, you know, I guess this is getting a little bit into the weeds and maybe, you know, into a bigger business type situation, but, you know, you have to build a standard operating procedure so you have employees that can follow them. And so I had to build those from the very beginning. So I would build an SOP and I would bring on an assistant and my assistant would help me, you know, and you can hire people all over the, you know, whether it be the country, the world, wherever, and you give yourself so much freedom. It's so nice to actually have someone who's working for you and doing the right job. And, you know, and that's where I've done a really great job. And I tell anybody who will listen, all my friends is, hey, you need an assistant. You know, you're busy, you're working. And I take the step back and say, you know, anyone who is a busy professional or anyone who wants to build a side hustle or any of that kind of thing, you need extra hands and you need, you know, and I think the executive assistant or virtual assistant, you know, they've been rebranded a few times. That was really the big difference maker on my side was, you know, I had a full-time employee working at a very reasonable rate. You know, we can dive into that a little deeper.
Yeah, let's go there. But before we even do that, let's talk about like what's necessary to do that. You mentioned an SOP. So one thing I tell, especially solopreneurs, if you intend to grow your business beyond yourself, you need to literally think like a programmer. Like programmers document everything they do. Yep. Like every line of code that's updated, they document why it was done. If it was a bug fix, what did it fix? Et cetera. So the next programmer can come in and look at the code plus the documentation. And then you say, I want it to do X. They can either say, well, the last guy tried to do that and it broke it. Or, okay, I can make it do that now. Or you shouldn't do that because, but they can make that determination for you. But, you know, when you deal with a programmer, you're dealing with a fairly intelligent person that's good at picking things apart. When you're hiring a virtual assistant to handle things like you're talking about, you may not be dealing with somebody quite that proactive. So then it becomes even more important that you can say, I need you to do these tasks and here's how they get done. That way they're done the Nate way, because it's not just about it getting done and getting done right. You set an expectation to your customer, right? I always say like every day you interact with your customer, you are training your customer how to do business with you. So you
That's very true.
Invested in that. And now you want the, you know, whoever you hire to handle things the way that Nate's company does business.
Yeah. So you definitely need, you know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs and side hustles are built in the wrong way, is that every business should be built to sell. And that's, you know, the intent. I mean, I don't plan on selling my business, but maybe down the road, you know, if somebody offered me a whole bunch of money, maybe that would be the case. But you build from the ground up as though you are potentially going to sell the business. And I tell you what makes a business worthwhile and valuable to someone else is processes. Is they come in and they don't see it's, oh, well, it's only just the owner and he does everything. And all of a sudden, you know, that business is worth much less than a business that has processes, that has examples to follow, that has documentation. And that was the big thing for me. And again, that way in the early stages, when I had no other choice but to document that information for my team to follow, it was kind of a blessing in disguise. I mean, it was a brutal thing to go through in the beginning when I didn't know what I was doing, but it's definitely paying off now. Definitely paying off.
And so you are scaling to replace yourself. So basically you're an owner, less an operator.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Is that why you've chosen, like, even though this seems like it's really successful, to remain employed while building it?
Well, and so it's an interesting inflection point. I am at the end of my tenure working for my current employer. So I've, you know, officially given them notice and I'm actually moving on from that. And,
okay,
you know, I'll have a lot more time to do what I want to do. But, I a little bit about, you know, on me is I've always liked my employer. I've liked what I've done. They've always been really good to me. And to be fair, I could always balance working on the side. You know, I'd put in, you know, 3 or 4 hours in the morning before I go to work, you know, get my task done, keep building the business and moving on. And I was able to balance that with a full-time job. And lately it's become a lot harder with everything else going on and I have bigger aspirations. And the reality is, you know, one business lesson I think a lot of people will learn is opportunity cost. You can't do X while doing Y. So I can't build the business while working for someone else's business. And that's the trade-off that, you know, we make a lot of times. And I've just determined it's time for me to move on. So I am on my way out.
Did you get to a point where you felt this way? Like when I was building this and working for another company, again, I was an owner in it, but I was effectively an employee as to how I was being paid. In the beginning, I felt like it's hard, but I can do this. And I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I was boundless with energy and all. And there is a point where you're like, man, I can't keep this dual candle thing going anymore, burning at both ends.
Yeah.
I have got to lay down and hit something hard. And I think when you get to that point, and if the business you've built is sufficient to make a living with, you're always going to choose your baby over somebody else's.
Well, and nobody's going to take care of you like you'll take care of you. So, you know, like in my instance, you know, where, you know, the income from the business, you know, pays for all of our expenses and, you know, I make a comfortable living from it. You know, it was time for me to just step away. I realized it just, you know, you keep kicking the can down the road, and I've done it so many times. You know, last year I said, it's going to be this year. It's going to be next month. It's going to be later in the year. You know, you always wait for the next shoe to drop. I don't know why I did that. And I think it's just human psychology. You know, we stick with the devil we know versus the devil we don't.
Well, and there are some things that, you know, I did it for 18 months and that's relatively short, but there's still things that were like, man, I'm giving some stuff. Like one was health insurance. Like, I'm going to go from having full health insurance paid for by the company. I'm going to be spending hundreds of dollars a month on my health insurance. Like that was a big one. The other thing was like, I don't think, and there's some ways to mitigate this with S-corps and all, but like you have to have some income that you're going to pay SSI on. And like when I was doing this, I think the cap on SSI was like right at 100,000, a little over, a little under, something like that. And basically I hit the cap plus with my employment income. So effectively I was paying no matching SSI.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
Right. So because the employer was covering the matching up to the cap, and I think the cap's now almost 200. So they've jacked it way up. So that would be good now. Yeah. But even half of it, like that's nice. Right. So like those are things that people don't factor in. And you say, well, I'm making double the income in like net profit, but you might still be break even over employment until you hit a certain level where things kind of shift.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think you've talked about it a little bit, but for people who, you know, don't have their own business, you pay payroll tax, you know, as both the employer and the employee, if I remember rightly. I mean, there's both sides, which I think, you know, in most instances, the employer covers. You know, you have a 401k match, you've got healthcare insurance, like you talked about. I mean, so there are real reasons to stay an employee, especially in the right situation. You know, I really do believe that if you're in a revenue generating role, like a sales position where you actually have, you're providing a good return to the company and they're paying you some kind of a commission structure, you know, those roles, generally speaking, come with more freedom. You know, they have, whether it be location freedom or time freedom. I mean, some of those are really worth sticking with, but you know, even still, a good job doesn't always last forever. And again, the only person that takes care of you is going to be you.
Yeah, I would say if a person is on commission and that's the majority of their salary, or if they're on a straight commission, like the employer shouldn't have anything to say about anything other than thank you and sign the paycheck.
For sure.
When you're on like 100% salary or hourly, like I can understand an employer being like, hey, where are your loyalties? And I still think like, well, I walked out the door, I don't work for you anymore. If I'm not poaching your customers, leave me alone. But a lot of people don't feel that way. In fact, a very good friend of mine fired one of his employees over a decade ago. This happened, and he was kind of shocked that I didn't agree with him. The guy was making Kydex holsters on the side, and this friend of mine is in that space, but he didn't make holsters. And I'm like, I don't think the guy did anything wrong. He's like, he should have brought it to me. I'm like, why?
Yeah, exactly.
Why couldn't he have brought it to you? Like, you know, he wanted something of his own. And I'm like, did he download your customer database and email it or something? He's like, no. I'm like, yeah, I don't really see the harm.
There's a sense of entitlement there for sure.
Yeah. I think it was also, he was a very new entrepreneur and he was still thinking like an employee.
People get scared
in a lot of ways, you know. You know, we could have done that, but you didn't, and you still can. And I'm just pointing out to people that are in your situation in that transitional state, keeping it on the down low is probably a pretty good idea. I mean, I couldn't, because I was a podcaster.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I either had to use a pseudonym and lie about who I was or be honest, but I had some ability to leverage some things. And funny enough, as big as it grew, as fast as it did, my partners didn't know what I was doing until I told them. And then they thought I was crazy. They're like, "You're going to go do this?" I'm like, "I would already have left if you didn't beg me to stay twice." Like, yeah, I mean, like, I just think the space we were in, and they were selling, big clients like AT&T and whatever, they couldn't understand how you were going to make money with a podcast.
Well, and, people never think anything can succeed. They always think less of someone else's dream. And, your dream is not for anyone else to see. That's the truth.
Yeah, man. That's definitely the case. So let's talk about, to do what you're doing with scale. We talked about this a little bit already, but you have to build systems. In this case, there's certain things you can't do because you're still working. You have to figure out how to take your limitation and turn it into a strength. So can you kind of speak to that?
Yeah, for sure. So when I started, as I was working full time, you have a business phone number, and people are calling you. Well, I can't answer the phone when I'm at work. Obviously that would be, and that wouldn't be fair to my employee,
no.
employer either.
Yeah.
Fairly speaking. Of course maybe you send them the voicemail, and that kind of worked for a little bit. I think in the very beginning I had a Google Voice phone number or something, and it kind of worked. Sometimes people left messages, sometimes it didn't. But what I ended up doing was I ended up setting up a call service. One of the people who are live operators, they take the calls, they take all their information. And the reason that was really good was, I could walk outside on my lunch break. I already had all of the qualification information from a customer. They say, "Hey, I'm working on this piece of equipment, whether it's, a dozer or an excavator or whatever. I already know what it is, and I can try and at least have some background information and try and help them." I can call them right then. The reason why we turned that into a strength, it was a limitation in the beginning, but all of a sudden, every single call that came in, we had it logged in a call log. And I tell you why that's really good was I was able to follow up with people. And so I had a routine. Again, I built a process behind following up with people. I would just go back through the call log and say, "Oh, well, I haven't heard from, so-and-so and Joe's Excavation or whatever." And I'd be able to say, "Okay, well, they needed parts," and I could call them back. And, I would just pretty much do that. I'd roll through the, like an old analogy, if you had a Rolodex, it was a Rolodex of all the people that called in. And okay. I'd be able to say, "Okay, you didn't order, you did order." And I could just keep rolling through until, I got an order or they didn't need it anymore. And so that was a big step forward. I also got people's email addresses. So when they'd call in, get their email, and I could start email marketing to them. And so all of this stuff, even though I couldn't answer the phone, started to build a system behind it. Will we get people into our world? We can potentially market to them on the back end. We can maybe sell them something down the road because they'll know about us. And you kind of have to think this way because you'll never have unlimited time. You'll never have unlimited money. And you kind of have to use the resources you got and be tenacious that way. I think that was a big step forward for us.
That is turning a weakness or a limitation into an advantage. And I'll tell you why it's an advantage. Because many people who were not put in that position would have just been able to handle all the calls, and I'll get a database someday, right? You were forced to put the documentation customer database building system into place. You did not have a choice, and therefore it happened. And I mean, the number one thing you want to make sure of, just from a previous owner standpoint, if I terminate a salesperson, the one thing I want to make sure I do is terminate them before they have an opportunity to get their hands on the entire company's database of customers, right?
I don't
want that. Which the reason I bring that up is not an ethical thing. It's more of a value thing, right? The value of the database of the customer is more the value of the company than anything else. When one
customer
buys another company, they're not buying the ability to manufacture widgets.
Yeah.
They're not. There's nothing in the world today other than a very few things that is so proprietary that you're buying the thing. You're buying the customer base.
Absolutely.
And this is why so many entrepreneurs, they don't build databases. Like all these people that are TikTokers and YouTubers and shit, and they're like, I get that your margin's 1,000% because you have no real cost of business. Okay, I get it. That's good. But you're getting your money from TikTok or you're getting your money from Google, and you're doing nothing to build. And then they introduce memberships and shit. And so they're all in your membership. Okay, great. So you have your YouTube handle and you really can't do much with it. All of those people need to be emulating you, even though you're in a totally different business, and you need to somehow be migrating your followers, your listeners, your lookers, whatever you want to call them, into something where you can communicate directly with them, or you have nothing the day that you're turned off, or that they just change the rules. Like I mentioned earlier that I made a lot of money in the heavy equipment business with Google AdSense back in the day. I would make a little mini site about excavators and shit like that and throw AdSense on it, and then I would push cheap traffic there and resell the traffic.
Nice.
Right? And that's great until Google just said, you know what, we've killed out all the competitive advertising platforms. We're just going to cut the commission to like 2% of what it used to be. And so I went from making like $8,000 a month to making like $800 a month because somebody changed the rules. Well, there was no way for me to build a customer database with that model, but I was at that point, and I was probably in my 20s at the point, I'm like, you know what? That's never fucking happening again. Like anything I do will have customer information capture as part of a process. And what you were doing there is you weren't just catching that information from buyers, which people don't do that. And that drives me nuts because that's your gold, right? But you were catching that information from prospects so you could follow up with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you don't have a way to call somebody, I mean, at least in our industry, if you can't call them, you might as well be dead in the water. I mean, email works to a certain extent, but everybody wants to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
So if I can't call my customer back, I might as well not have customers.
Yeah. And that's knowing your market too, because the guy you're talking to is probably a foreman or a project manager, and he's sitting on the side of the road looking at a busted ass machine that's going to cost him $1,500 a day or more until it runs again. And I need this freaking part. And there's that one of the good things about your business, there's times where they need a part, they don't give a fuck what it costs as long as it's not being exorbitant, because the cost of that machine not moving, if it's on a lease and it's not doing things, right, or even if it's on a payment plan like I bought it.
Oh, gosh, it's brutal.
That thing sitting there, we had figured out, I think, our little 7-Eleven Vermeer directional boring machines were about the entry-level product there. And if that machine was sitting, it was costing us $900 a day for it to sit there and do nothing. And that was back in 1998.
Wow. Right?
Wow.
So it's money.
Looking at, you know, some of these machines out there that can pull a pipe the size of a 55-gallon drum in the ground, sitting, not moving. If I'm that PM, my ass is puckered and I'm scared, right? Like, I can't afford for that machine not to run.
You bring up a good point, especially about equipment. And the reality is, like in our world, a lot of times manufacturers obsolete equipment and they do it relatively quickly. Yes, and then they don't make the parts any longer. And then all of a sudden, you know, you can't call CAT or you can't call, you know, JLG or you can't call any of these guys. And, you know, you have to go aftermarket. And that's where the aftermarket support that we have is why it's so valuable. You know, we have we supply items for older equipment that nobody else makes anymore. So.
See, and then what you're hitting on there, to make it more general for the audience, is you knew your niche. You know how that project manager or that whatever, that owner of that small company feels looking at that rock saw sitting on the side of the road that won't run, right? Like, you're just angry, mad. And so you know how to talk to those people, but then I think the important thing was you developed a system so that when you hired somebody that says, make these calls, they knew how to talk to them.
For sure. For sure. No, and a lot of times speed is a really important factor, but also the convenience of just going on. And, you know, the Amazon world has killed a lot of things because of that, but they've also made it easy. You know, people are used to convenience. If they can go right online and find exactly what they want and buy it, you know, again, like I mentioned and on the other feed before we cut off, was instead of having to call 10 different places who, you know, sell that brand of equipment and only getting one call back, it's incredibly frustrating to not be able to buy something. You know, as you said in the past, don't hate money. And these guys hate money. You know, they have somebody who works at the counter of the inside sales department and they don't care whether they get a sale or not.
Well, in some of those big shops too, they're like, okay, so we're going to have to get you set up in the system and we need you to fill out a credit app. And you're like, I just want to pay for it now.
Yeah, right? Like, I just give you my credit card.
Did you have a D&B number? Or like, you're like, I need a piston and it's $2,000 and I have $2,000 and I want my piston. And the fact that they can go to a website and just basically order it like they're ordering any other part for any other thing. Because what it actually makes me think of, and it's unrelated, but it's related, is when you go to buy a part from an auto parts store, It's the most aggravating thing in the world. I need 6 feet of 5/8-inch fuel line. What's what the main model? Yeah. Four-wheel drive. Motherfucker. I said,
what engine size do you have?
I need 6 feet of 5/8-inch fuel line. And they can't think. They're there like...
Yep, got to click the button.
It's a Brontosaurus mobile, yep. Right? With a V18 engine. Like, you just start giving them crap. Like, and then they're trying to find it. And it's kind of fun until you're like, look, man, Can I just get the fuel line? And
I can see it behind the counter. It's right there.
Cut it. Charge by the foot. Right. And so by having the convenience of online, but a human that will call you when you're standing on the side of the road trying to get a job back on track, that establishes a relationship. And then that person's like, well, I want to do business with this company because if they'll call me, that means I can call them and they'll talk to me when I have a problem because everybody screws up eventually, and what people really want to know is, will you fix it?
Absolutely.
And the first step in fixing it is, can I talk to somebody instead of a chat bot?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
No, it's the truth. Absolutely. You got to be in front of your customers.
How do you find your niche? And I kind of know how you found your niche. You're in the industry, you know, the language, the lingo, whatever. That's probably a good place for anybody to start. But I'm asking more broadly, like, how does somebody find the niche that's going to work for them to build something like this?
Here's my recommendation, and I think I'm pretty sure this came from a Harvard Business Marketing course, and I think you probably will know the answer. So if so, don't give it away right away. But if you had a hot dog shop and you had one competitive advantage, well, and you could have anything in the world. You could have you could have the best hot dogs, you could have the best meat, you could have the best buns, you could have whatever you wanted. If you had one competitive advantage, what would it be?
Best location.
According to the business course,
yeah,
it would be a hungry audience.
Okay, which
you set up outside of a stadium, or you set up somewhere where and so like the reason I picked in that, this is where I built way too many businesses that crashed and burned and didn't work, and you try to jam a square peg in a round hole, and what I figured out in this particular instance was, you find your starving audience, and that's really what it was. And so the guy who's calling in to order parts, at least in our industry, is they already have the equipment. They're not just going to go buy another piece unless it's totally destroyed and beat up, but they're going to try and fix what they have, right? So we have a captive audience in our world, and they need the parts for the equipment they have. So again, we kind of have that starving audience type deal of where we go. So that's kind of like my first recommendation, is figure out, where is there a starving audience that's underserved? And that's kind of what I figured out online, is that for the parts that we sell, there isn't another market. It's crazy. There's not another marketplace out there. We have the only storefront online to go and buy them. And so I always just found that was crazy. So that's kind of like the first step. Or, it said in another way, there's what's called the Blue Ocean Strategy, which is a great book anybody can read, but essentially is, you go to a pond, that has tons of fish in it, but no one fishes in it, and you're going to have better luck there. And so the Blue Ocean Strategy is another great way to try and figure that out. Now, if you're looking actual tactical, how do I figure this out? Google Trends is a great way to see search traffic. You can go online if you want to look up an industry, if you want to look up a brand name, if you want to look up equipment numbers, say you want to do something similar to what we do. You can look all that up. And if there's tons of traffic for something and there's nowhere for it to go, as in it just goes to, like Wikipedia, and people are looking for how to buy, buy X, Y, and Z, that's really going to be a great potential business. And like I said before, is if you have to call, Joe Schmo's equipment rental or equipment fix, company, and then you have to call three other companies after that, and they don't have a decent website, and it's a pain to get a call back on, and like, for instance, if you had to buy something, like I have a Coyote tractor, if I had to call 12 different Coyote dealerships to try and get an answer, well, I don't know. Coyote parts might be a great thing to try to resell online, as an example. You know what I mean? And it's just, again, it's not. And, to be fair, if I was one of those people looking for parts and I had to pay $3 or $4 more just to go online to buy a saw blade or a belt or a pulley, I'd go spend the $3 or $4 or whatever, the percentage is above it, because I can just order online. Then, they'll ship it and I don't have to wait 7 days for a call back.
Yeah. Yeah, when I used to do the little side podcast, 5 Minutes with Jack, it was all business-centric. You're giving me a flashback to an episode I did where I was talking about how to identify opportunity and niche, and the whole pretext of that was, who are they, what do they want, and how do they want it?
Mm-hmm.
And what I hear you saying is, you found a hole. Everybody knows who they are. Everybody knows what they want. But the hole was in delivering it in the way that they wanted it, which was quick, fast, affordable, and without a bunch of bullshit. And I think finding a niche is if you can find a market and you can identify who those people are and you can identify precisely what they want, and then you can identify the pain point of it not coming to them the way that they wish for it to come to them, if you can fix that, and kind of on the hot dog analogy, right? If you have the right location, you can use Oscar Mayer's and store-bought freaking buns that sell a shitload of hot dogs.
Of course.
If you can put it in a way that is how, which is the hot dog person's like, I want a hot dog now. There's a hot dog guy there, and there's no line. I'm going to go buy the freaking hot dog, right? Yeah. Like, there's a better hot dog 5 miles down the road. I don't give a shit. I want a hot dog now, right? And that heavy equipment company, any company running heavy equipment, I want my equipment to run or it eats money.
Yep.
So
yep.
If you could fix the how, which sounds like, and I didn't know this, it's a big problem to get parts for a lot of equipment, especially maybe aged equipment, which is the equipment that needs parts.
Yep, absolutely. And a lot of people still have. I mean, people keep equipment for 30, 40, 50 years. So absolutely.
Off other than parts, right? Like, I know dudes that are running tractors from the 60s, and those things still run. I mean,
absolutely.
They run well. Like, yeah.
So maybe, you know, with that in mind of for like what to look for, you know, what not to look for would be if it's sold on Amazon, you can probably guarantee it's not a good business to get into. I mean, I can't say that for 100% of the time, but most things, you know, that are sold on Amazon and, you know, and are consumerized that way, they're not going to be a good option to look into. Generally speaking, like, for instance, I would never want to sell carburetor kits for steel chainsaws as an example. You know, you can buy them anywhere. You know, you can go on Amazon, you can go on, probably you can buy them on Temu or something for all I know.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it still doesn't fit the model of it's not expensive enough. You know, you want it to be higher dollar.
Well, like, so you have products that are in specialty niches and you have products that are commodities. And commodity products are always a race to the bottom.
Yes.
Whoever indeed. Can figure out how to sell it for the least amount of money and still make a profit will end up being the number one seller of the thing. And that's a commoditized product. And the way you know is if you search for the specific thing you're looking for and there's 10 listings on Google and you click every one and you could have bought that product from any of those 10 people easily in a couple, you know, a couple clicks and filling out a form and putting a card number in, you have a commoditized product. There's nothing unique about it, and then anybody else can come into that space and start selling that product. When you try to buy something and you have difficulty buying it or difficulty finding it, it doesn't mean that it's a perfect product for you because it may be a bad fit. There may be a reason that it's a problem, but if you can solve the pain point, now you've got something.
For sure. Yeah, and so I don't think I've said it before, but the great part about my business is that it's mostly dropship. So, you know, we've found, you know, finding vendors is a whole other topic, and you know, you have to do it right and you have to vet them and you have to make sure that they're good. And
yeah,
not to mention that they won't steal your customers, which is another thing.
They will.
but you know, you have to, you know, you want to have product that is readily available. And you know, we import a lot. We order a lot of stuff from Italy, and you know, and that's, you know, most places are fine with a short lead time. Now, when you get to like, you know, the 8 and 12 week lead time, that's a different story. But
yeah,
we found that most people are relatively reasonable unless they need it right this second. It's in the shop. I need to have the kit for it right, you know, right now. You know, but for most people, you know, even a short lead time is reasonable. So finding those good vendors and being able to drop ship from them, you know, because we don't have a big location. You know, I stock some inventory here in a limited way, but having those good vendors, you know, one of those key things you have to stress is finding those good vendors who are willing to work with you. And, you know, being able to drop ship stuff is a gigantic reason to keep our overhead down. You know, we don't have to keep a lot of inventory. And obviously, you know, you pay shipping on each one, but at least you know you're only paying shipping on product that's sold. When you bring in inventory, you don't know if it's going to, I mean, you think it might sell, but you have no guarantee that it's actually going to go. So it's something to keep in mind.
Not to mention in some states, there's an inventory tax at the end of the tax year and you don't have any inventory. You don't have any tax.
I think Texas has one of all places, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, they do.
That's like, that was the least, I expected at least out of all the states to have that when I heard that.
It's pretty low relative to other states, but it does exist. And we also have jurisdictions that pull bullshit. Like back when we were in the directional boring world, We had the city of Fort Worth try to property tax us on our equipment that we didn't own because it was all leased. And we just didn't pay them. And they said we had to. And we said, well, good luck with that. We never heard anything else, so we didn't worry about it. But, you know, basically we got the bill, and we called up and said, we're not doing this. And they said, well, you know, you'll get in trouble if you don't do it. So we're not doing it. Talk to our attorney. And then nobody said anything. And it was like they were just sending it all out and seeing who would pay it. Because a lot of, you know, a company bigger than ours may have just, like, went to accounts payable and went, okay, and paid. It was like, it wasn't huge, but it was like $1,800.
$1,800 from how many different companies?
Yeah, yeah.
It adds up quick.
Yeah.
More extortion.
What is your procedure? Like, how do you find customers?
So in our world, Google Ads is really the biggest driver. So, you know, that was, you know, one thing I was going to bring up in here is, you know, what I think Scott Adams, who wrote the old Dilbert comics, you know, he talks about the talent stack. And the talent stack is all those different skills that, you know, might be all disconnected and disjointed, but you bring them together and you make a whole system out of them. You know, and that's, you know, for instance, I learned Google Ads way back in the day. And that was one of the things that was kind of like my main responsibility when I started on the journey was, okay, I have to figure out how to get new customers, you know, because obviously I can do everything in the world. I can have the best website. It can be the prettiest. It can have all the parts anybody wants. But if people can't find me or if they have trouble, you know, I'm not going to get any orders. And so that was my big focus very on was, you know, okay, let's go to, you know, we're going to set up Google Ads campaigns. And, you know, anybody who's setting up Google Ads and who isn't aware with it, you know, just a little bit of knowledge is that when you set them up, you're going to have some testing. And the testing does come with, you know, upfront cost. You know, you can just expect to spend, a few hundred or $1,000 or $2,000 testing to figure out which ads work. And Google Ads is our biggest driver for sure. Now we're currently employing, and this is pretty interesting. I think a lot of people would find it interesting as well, is there's technology that you can add onto your website and see who these anonymous visitors are, especially in like a B2B situation. So the companies who are the other equipment companies, and, you know, that's a segment of our customers that we sell to are other equipment companies. You know, they don't deal with all the other brands. They might only deal with Case as an example, but they don't deal with, you know, the Cats and all that stuff. But they got one in the fix because the customer has one and they need a piston or a cylinder or whatever for it. And, you know, they don't deal with everybody. But because of that, you know, they're looking around trying to see where they can find those parts. And so having that technology on our website that identifies anonymous visitors is super powerful. You know, obviously they're, so think about this, you know, obviously every lead you pay for is a lead that you need to try to close. But what about the people who don't come as leads? You know, all those people who are lost potential prospects. You know, if you could get a fraction of those people into your world, onto your email list, into your marketing segment, and potentially buy something down the road, you know, like I talked before, it's kind of like adding rocket fuel to an engine. It's a massive driver. And I think that's where we're going to see really big growth here coming in the next year.
It would seem like your niche is a really great one for farming, right? Farming the customer database too, because
yeah,
basically mining and farming are your two business models. Take all you can or cultivate what you have. And good businesses do both. They bring in new business and they cultivate business. So each customer has a very high potential long-term value. So they rate the occasional phone call and things like that. And if you can build a relationship between the company and the customer, then that customer's thinking, when I have a problem, this company is my first call because they're there. They take the call. They call me. They're not a pain in the ass. They're not always trying to hustle me and sell me something. They just check in. Hey, how are things going? Did that part work out for you? Is there anything else we can do for you? That type of thing.
The other thing that we've done really well, which has been, it was a little bit of work. I should say a lot of work up front, which was SEO. You know, so people in our world, they kind of know what they're looking for. And a lot of times they have, you know, breakdowns of the equipment they're looking at. And they say, oh, I need part number 12345.
Yeah.
And then they go and search for that part number online. And, you know, we've gone through all the manuals and we've added all those parts on the website. And it was a bear to do in the beginning, but it has paid off long term. So, and that's a big way other people find us.
Boy, that's some yummy long tail right there, though.
Folks. No doubt.
People that don't know the term long tail, when you look at any industry and you look at search volume, all the competition is in the highly searched terms. But those terms are not necessarily buyer's terms. They're researcher's terms. They're a kid in school doing a project report. They're, I'm going to buy it maybe someday. I'm dreaming about it someday. It's cell phone, for instance, would be a high target term. And then the search volume drops off, drops off, drops off, drops off. And it's almost nothing. That term gets 100 searches a quarter or something like that. And then it's a long-ass tale of all these things, like a part number specific to a piece of equipment, right?
There's your money.
Not that many people looking for it, but the guy looking for it wants to buy it. That's a buyer's search. And the cool thing is, when you look at that graph, if you take the long tail, the totality of the long tail, and you stand it up, there's actually more traffic in the tail than there is in what everybody's going after. So there's less competition and more active buyers. Now, that's changed over the years. Like, a lot of companies have switched on to this. Their ad strategy, et cetera, goes into the long tail. But there's also bigger companies get sloppy after a while, and they don't feel that they need to go into that level of effort. So the upstart can go into that tail, and boy, that's a way to hit that tail. Like, the black hat in me is thinking already about product catalogs and databases.
Exactly.
Rotating content to prevent duplication and like.
Well, and one thing we've done was, you know, we've made individual parts for each individual listings on the store for each individual part, you know, which adds to that SEO juice of all the things we offer. So, you know, all of a sudden we're at 5,000 parts, but you know, it or 5,000 web pages, but it's a worthwhile undertaking. The SEO is definitely worth it.
But when I'm looking for, you know, product XYZ PDQR for a cat, there's probably not a lot of places that are going to come up in a listing. So now, instead of buying that click for $10 or whatever, you're getting that organic traffic for free.
Exactly.
The work's done once, and the listing's there for a long time. So I think that's a fantastic strategy, and people can emulate that. They don't have to be in your industry to think that way. Like, you have to determine what the buyer is searching for, and I don't mean the product. I mean, what is the search query that buyer would use? What is the search query that only a buyer would use, right? So, like, cell phone is an example, right? Like, because I used to be in that industry with websites too, and cell phone could mean anything, right? But if somebody says cell phone service in Wauhegan, Connecticut, that is a buyer. That is a buyer. That person is specifically looking for service where they are. And that's what I was talking about, databases and all that. Back in the day when people really thought that way with cell service, like, because we didn't have universal everywhere service, I used the postal database, and I created a freaking page from auto-generated web content for every zip code, every state,
oh, no way,
every county, every state for cell phone service. Then I did it for remote internet access. Then I did it for satellite service, and I had like 10 websites, but each website had like 60,000 pages.
That's nuts. Man, that's crazy.
You know, and then what we also did, like, this is real evil shit. So they're all the same, so they get duplicate filtered. So then we took a bunch of, like, random tech articles and snippets of them, and we used PHP to pull them in at random. So every time that page loaded, the entire content of the page changed. But the core content and the keyword density and everything else stayed the same.
Yeah, you change your intent depending on who and where and why. Yeah, no, that's wild. That's cool. That's very cool.
I don't think that works like it used to. That's you know, we're going back 20, 25 years now. But that was like Black Hat Central back then. But you could still take the concept
of
the part, the location, whatever. Like, if you are if you're a homesteader, you need to own your city, your county, the biggest city near you, like all of those things. You need to build pages for that thing, because that's what the buyer is going to look for. The buyer's not going to look for duck eggs. They're going to look for Fort Worth duck eggs.
Yep.
Right. Because I want them where I am. Right. So your person is going to be looking for that specific part number or that specific model number for the machine that the part goes for, parts for a cat, you know, 135A or whatever the hell it is. Right. Like, they're going to look for that. And you know, that person is, they are not like kicking around, one day I might buy a skid steer for my farm. They're like, I need a part. I need a thing.
Absolutely.
You sell, right?
Now, if we take that just one step further, is after you have all those pages built, if you have some form of a lead magnet to get those people into your world, to give you an email, to give you a phone number, you know, you have all that traffic that's coming to your site. But if you can't get them into your world, again, you don't have anyone to contact. So, you know, think about that from a marketing perspective, is what can I give away for free that somebody would actually sign up for? You know, is it the guide to, you know, making better bacon or how to make hand cream, or I don't know, whatever it is for your particular industry.
If you own a Cat 135, here's the five spare parts you should keep on hand at all times.
For sure. Exactly.
Right. Something like that. Like, that's something I'm interested in, is somebody that owns that machine. Right. Like, these five things you should just have. right? Or like, here's the top 10 pieces of heavy equipment that are used in America today, and this is the associated inventory owners of that equipment should have.
Yeah, the novelty stuff actually does work pretty well. People just like to know, oh, what's the most popular, you know, X, you know, most popular. People just think it's cool. So like that, that actually could work for sure. That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. Anything you could do to move the person from a looker to somebody in your database. It's honestly, it's 1970s back of the book marketing on computers, right? Yeah. People wrote all these books of how to do shit in the 70s. They made no money on the book itself. But, you know, they sold 100,000 copies of the book, and then the back of the book sold other shit. And then that's how they made all their money, right? Like, because the person that would buy this book would probably buy one of these 10 items. Yeah. And so the book became the customer paid to be advertised to.
Well, and that's, I mean, there's also, I mean, affiliates are a real thing, you know, trademark newsletters are, you know, those are whole, we haven't dived into those and, you know, actually gone deep, but those are real things. I mean, so, you know, if you're in this space or in a similar space, there's definitely some kind of publication you can advertise in.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And again, targeted publication. You're not going to advertise in Time Magazine for this.
Yeah, precisely. You
know, yep, Heavy Equipment Weekly or whatever it is. I don't know. Like, there has to be journals, et cetera, for that specific niche. And there's people looking at that niche while they take a dump at the office because, oh, shit, I can get a part from these people. Like, I mean, really, like, that's just how the world works. You also had in your notes, I really love this quote. It said, you need the discernment to determine what to learn next. And you talked about kind of that skill stack, right? So How does that fit in?
Yeah, so this quote comes from Alex Hormozi, and this was like my 2024 quote. I heard it at the beginning of the year. He was on a podcast and said that, and I thought about it all year long. And as business owners, or even even people in high performing professional situations, you know, you're constantly on the lookout for new information, right? You know, if you're a lifetime learner, and I've been cursed by this, I love to read, I love to watch YouTube videos, I like to learn everything I can. At a certain point, especially when you kind of move into that entrepreneur journey, is you have to be able to winnow out the stuff that you don't need to learn any longer. And what I mean by that is I can learn all day long about, TikTok or how to write copy, or, you know, you could name any business example. But the reality is I have a deficit in this one area, and my one area might be in email marketing. And I really need to set up this email marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. I need to learn that first. I need to learn that thing right now. So you need the clarity to be able to step back and say, this is the area I'm lacking. This is where I kind of need to get a leg up on. This is where I have to really step up. And you have to dive in on that one particular area. And unfortunately, that means that you can't be learning all of the other, maybe more generalist information that you were sucking in over here. You know, you cut that out. And there is, in my opinion, there's no easier or faster way to get to forward momentum than learning the things you absolutely have a skill deficit on now. Mm. You have to.
So it's the skill deficit, but what I'm also hearing in there is identify the things that will cost you forever if you don't do them today.
Yeah,
if you don't have good email marketing set up, you don't have good information capture set up, every day people are coming to your website and they're interacting with you. And every day you're not collecting their data or marketing to them is a day you'll never get back. And 10 years from now, even if you have, you know, squared that away, all the time in between, that cost you, and it cost you forever.
It does.
What we call permaculture, right? It's a type one error. You regret it forever from the day you do it forward, right? That's really what that is, because that person that showed up, diddled around, and maybe even interacted with you, but you didn't collect their data, and you didn't start marketing to them, and you didn't start communicating, you are forgotten before lunch.
It's true.
You're gone. You don't exist anymore. And it's, you wasted that interaction. Like, you worked so hard, like you said, advertising, et cetera, to bring people to you. If you're not capitalizing it after they come, then all of that was wasted, and it was wasted forever.
No, and it, you know, there's, as an entrepreneur or business owner, there's a million things to learn. I need to learn accounting. I need to learn, inventory management. I need to learn all these things, and they're constantly coming at you, and they will as a barrage for the rest of your life. I think I'm pretty sold on that, but you have to take a step back and see, what's my biggest issue right now? What do I need to solve? You know, what's my highest leverage activity? If I fix this one little thing in the business, and I was able to, you know, to multiply revenue or bring costs down or whatever it is, how do I learn to do that? And then you kind of just have to dive in on that one thing. So you kind of have to and sometimes it's even good to ask someone else who maybe isn't real familiar with your situation or your business, but maybe you can just do a quick description. And people seeing it from the outside in, they give you clarity because, you know, sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. And it's a real struggle.
And I think on the skill set, too, you also have to ask yourself, am I better off learning this or hiring this, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
You mentioned accounting. I have a great CPA. I'm a pretty good accountant, honestly. I have an accounting background. But, I mean, I do enough accounting that she can do her job. And I'm not going to become CPA level and do my own taxes because, one, first of all, I have a CPA to represent me, right?
For sure.
And there's a certain legal shielding to that. Well, of course I thought this was right. My CPA, who is certified in the state of Texas, told me it was. Just like my lawyer said this was okay, right? And tax attorney. But the bigger thing is I am not going to do that on a regular basis in my business. Like, this is a quarterly and annually thing. So if I take the time to become that good at it, I've just wasted that time because I could have hired somebody for a fraction of the value of my time over 10 years that it took me to do that, right?
For sure. Time investment's a big thing.
Or if like graphics design, like, that's fine. But like most businesses aren't putting out new graphics every day. Like, why are you learning how to design? Why are you fucking around with your logo? Hire somebody, get it done, put it on the site. If it doesn't look good, change it, right? Like, that's not where the entrepreneur needs to be spending their time on something that's, we talked about already, like the niche you are in. You really don't want to be in a commodity business. You want to be in a true niche business. Because as a small entrepreneur, you're going to get killed if you're in a commodity business. Well, you also don't want to spend your time doing commodity skills. If you can hire somebody to do something for $100 and it's something it's done 4 or 5 times a year, you really have no business doing that unless you really, really are interested in it because you like it. Like,
agreed.
It doesn't make any sense for you to fuck with that because there's something far more core to the business. Like you said, the thing that will give you the greatest leverage by getting it done, that's where your time needs to go. And I think people struggle with that because, I don't know, I think part of it is like, a lot of it, like I hit on graphics because there's people, that's their obsession. The way it looks, there's there's 1,000 people that can do that for you waiting to do that for you for a few $100. Right? Like that's not where you need to be. Yeah, $5. You go to Fiverr, right? Of course, with all the inflation, I think Fiverr is going to become tenner, but, you know.
That's a good one.
20.
Jack, while we're on the hiring subject, before we had our audio issues, do you want to jump back to the hiring virtual assistants? Because I think we kind of lost over.
Yeah, I think we kind of lost some of that. Sure. Go ahead.
One thing that I think we, and I'll say it again, if I'm repeating myself, I can't remember what I said on the previous stream and this stream, but I think hiring a virtual assistant, whether stateside or worldwide, is a fantastic idea for growth and also for moving to the next step in your business. Like an example that maybe brings it more, you know, down to home is if you have a homesteading business and you grew wedding flowers as an example, and you know, you were kind of like a florist, right? You're growing flowers, you're selling the florist, all that kind of stuff. Okay. You know, you need to be out there in the garden, you know, checking on your flowers, cutting flowers, et cetera, versus, you know, online posting pictures and trying to, you know, communicate with other florists and all that stuff. You can take that set of responsibilities and give that to someone who, you know, could be a world away.
Yeah.
And is able to do all that work for a fraction of the cost and also frees you up to make that much more money. So for every hour you get back of your time, you have, you know, an unlimited multiple of how much more money you can make, you know, yourself. If you make, you know, a few sales calls or if you make, you plant some more flowers or whatever, you know, focus on the things that actually bring you revenue in the very beginning and offshore or offload the admin tasks to someone else who is, you know, absolutely competent, can do them, can follow an SOP. But that's going to be your biggest driver to get to the next level. And I think that's where most entrepreneurs get stuck. You know, they call it the freelancer's trap because, you know, you sell a product. Like, for instance, if you grew flowers, you sell a product. Well, now I got to go plant them and now I have to harvest them and now I have to bring them to shop. And I can't look for new business while I'm doing that fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And so by having someone else on your team who can help out with those general admin tasks or billing or whatever it is, you're able to do all those things and look for new business at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the ways to look at it is something that you do every day that anybody could do,
mm-hmm.
right? Can you train somebody to do the thing that you're doing every day in 30 minutes or less and have a reasonable expectation that they could be able to do it? Then they should probably be doing that, right? Because you can come up with 20 or 30 things like that and take all that time back and have one person doing it, you know, making 10 bucks an hour or something like that. And if you're not making more than that with your time, you're doing something wrong with your time.
For sure.
And you should be in a position of not can you afford them. You should be in a position you can't afford not to hire
exactly.
them. You can't afford not to do it, right?
Like, you hit it, man. You hit it. No, and so I think people don't understand how easy it actually is to hire someone. You know, there's plenty of job boards online, you know, and I've actually hired a lot from the Philippines, and I've actually had very, very good success because they're very Americanized. They understand what we do. They watch American TV, you know, that kind of thing. And you get very, very high quality workers for the $5 to $10 range, like very well qualified, can do almost anything. Like you get into that $10 range, you're talking about people who are higher level coders and people who have got better, you know, accounting degrees and crazy stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I just think, and you can hire these people part time. If you have a business, you can work out any arrangement with anyone you see fit. If you want to work for 10 or 20 hours a week, you can do that. You know, and this is, you know, the world is your oyster when you have a business because you get to set your own rules. And, you know, if they don't want to, you know, follow those rules, they don't have to work for you. There's somebody else. Yeah. There's somebody else who will do it.
The skills are commoditizable skills, and you need to treat them as what they are. Like, I think one of the things is we start doing things, we think, oh, I only can do it the best.
Well, yes.
There are certain things that don't need to be done the best. They just need to be done, right? They need to be done. And if it's a commoditizable skill and you're a business owner of a business doing $100, $200, $300, $500, $1 million a year, right? Like, and you're spending your time doing something that's a commoditized skill, again, unless it's just something you love or something like that, like
you're
really not putting your expertise where they're the most useful to the business.
And you're actually costing yourself and the business money, realistically, because you could be doing other things. Again, the revenue generating activities, whatever those are.
This is the old, you know, work on your business, not in your business.
Yeah, you hit it.
Concept, right? Yeah, and as I sit here saying all this, like, and yet I'm sitting here in a lifestyle business that will never be that. But there's a reason, like, because I'm a personality driven business, but what you're saying is how I built every other business that I ever built. Like, I don't want to be, I'm not sweeping the floor, not because it's beneath me. I'm not sweeping the floor because I can't afford to pay myself to sweep the floor. I can go outside of street. Anybody want a job? Yeah. 10 bucks an hour. Yeah. Here's a broom, sweep the floor. Like, I can't afford to do it. Because either I'm spending my time in the business doing something really far more important than sweeping the floor, or we all need personal time too. So if I'm doing everything, then my home life, my personal life suffers. And that's, you know, I want to start heading toward, I want to talk a little bit more about virtual assistants before we move on, but I want to start also heading toward like the exit strategy. There is a point where we get to where we need the exit strategy because otherwise I'm going to explode.
Like, for sure.
You know, I'm either the business is going to suffer and decline, or I'm not going to be able to keep doing this anymore. But before we get there, let's start a little bit more like, how do you find your virtual assistants? Do you use Fiverr? Do you go to job? Like, how do you find somebody and make sure, like, I can actually hire this person, let them do this, and they'll do it the way I want it done?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll tell you exactly how I do it. Just in quick summary, there is a site called onlinejobs.ph, and it is a Filipino job board, more or less. And you can go there, you can post a job posting. And what I like to do is go there and, you know, and I'll post a job posting for whatever we have, you know, whether it's a e-commerce admin, you know, customer service person, whatever. It could be an SEO person even. You know, you can post your job posting up there. And I try to make it interesting. You know, there's a million job posts where they're all bland and boring and come work for us, rah, rah, we're the best company you've ever seen. And, you know, and we're great. But, you know, I try and make it interesting to get people's attention right up front. And what I do is, you know, outline the job descriptions just like any other job post. And then I take them to a Google form. Yeah. So you're seeing like actual applicants online right now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're for a good employee, you're talking, you know, $4 to $8 an hour, which I think is very affordable for somebody who's just starting out and wants to try to get some help in their business. But what I do is then I take them, I built a Google form, it dumps them right into a Google form. You know, I get their basic information, name, email, phone number, et cetera, I'll be able to talk to them. And the big thing that I do, which makes the biggest difference, is I ask for a Loom video. And so what the Loom video does is there's a couple things that it does. One, if they can't record a Loom video of themselves, they're not going to be able to do a job online. over the internet. They don't have the technical chops to do it, right? The second thing is I get to see them. I get to see how they talk. I get to understand, do they have good English? Do their skills align with what they say their experience is, et cetera, et cetera. And then from there, after I kind of run through those Loom videos and pick my favorite people out, then I'll go and interview. And so at this point, I actually have, you guys probably think it's funny, I actually have one of my other virtual assistants interview my new virtual assistant, which is a hilarious thing, and I love it because I'm able to, kind of bring it full circle, and then I do a final interview, and we're able to just go ahead and grab one. And I tell you what, it's like 90% of the people we hire have a great hit rate, and they stay for a long, long time. So we have really good success with it.
Well, and I can see why you're using the Philippines. So here I was throwing stuff in while he was talking for those on the audio only on this online jobs.ph, and I just threw in inside sales. So we got Leah here, inside sales agent. She's willing to work 8 hours a day for $5 an hour, $880 a month. She has a bachelor's degree.
Yeah, right? For sure.
Her profile is she specializes in cold calling and setting appointments. Now, I don't need somebody to do that for me right now, but that's the perfect example of you talk about low risk of hiring somebody like that. So if you hired Leah here and she works for $880 a month is long enough to determine if anybody's going to work out.
For
sure.
You're
into it $900 freaking. You're giving up a car payment or something there at this rate of things today, which is insane. But you're in them at $900, and trust me, as an employer, you don't get to really look at an employee for that price.
No.
Right? You're probably going to spend more finding the employee than what she would cost. And I found her in like 3 seconds online with this website that Nate gave us. And I'm not saying run out and hire this gal. I have no idea if she's any good. You'd want to have some sort of vetting process. But the fact that you can find that many people that fast with that level of qualifications, pretty insane. And I wasn't aware that there was maybe less of a language barrier there than there is with some other outsourcing.
No, they're very solid. And again, that's what the Loom video does. You can see how good their English is, and you'll get all kinds.
Loom video, can you explain that a little bit?
So a Loom video is exactly what, like what you and I are doing, whether it's a live stream or whatever. So essentially, okay. It's loom.com.
Okay.
And it's a site that allows you to take a live video of yourself, kind of like a screen recording, but the picture is only focused on you versus your screen. And so I'll ask them just to do some general, interview questions and, respond to them. And I get to feel, what their energy is, how well they work, again, what their experience is, and see if anything kind of doesn't match. So, and they're great for, we use it all the time, even just for daily business. You're able to send something to a customer and explain like, hey, are you talking about like this part here? And you can sample it. So it's really useful. So, and they have a free version. I mean, you can do the paid one, which has some cool features, but a lot of cool tools.
Well, it's really cool because I know exactly who's going to be talking to my customer and what they're going to sound like when they talk to my customer. Cause I don't mean to pick on anybody or anything, but I get really frustrated when I'm spending my hard earned money with a company and I'm talking to a customer service rep and I don't know what they're saying. I have no idea. I mean, I've literally sat on hold for 10 minutes. To deal with something, let's say on Amazon, where I have to talk to somebody. And like, I'll wait 10 minutes. And when the person says, hello, is it so-and-so with Amazon? How may I help you? But I don't know what they said. I just go, and I just get in line and wait again until I get somebody I can, I'm not going to do this. I'm sorry. I'm not being xenophobic. I'm not being a dick. I'm just not sitting here not understanding the person on the other end of the phone. I don't feel, as a paying customer, I should need a translator to talk to your CSR.
No, and the reality is, these, generally speaking, we don't hire that type of role or that kind of person for a customer service or, customer-centric role. But, regardless, they're fantastic on e-commerce or admin tasks or whatever.
Yeah, and that's my thing. Like, you don't have to be a completely fluent English speaker if you're not speaking to my customer.
For sure.
If you can write well and you're not talking to me, I don't give a shit. But if I'm going to have you talking to people, then we got to have that work.
There's two things I need to say on that real quick. The reason why I encourage everyone to hire a lower cost employee is because everyone thinks they're a better manager than they are. Ah. You give a set of instructions and you're like, it's crystal clear. You could never mess this up. And you realize upon reflection, they didn't understand anything that I said. They you know, they completely misunderstood what I was trying to tell them. And then in retrospect, when you go back and look, you're like, oh, well, my direction sucked. And so, you know, you got to learn. And I'd rather learn on a $5 employee than I would on a $50,000 employee. You know
what
I mean?
That's a good point. You're going to screw up. So
you
spend less money when you screw up. And I love the idea, too, of like, however you're going to handle instructions, either do it written or do it, maybe use that Loom thing or something like it and do it where it's a recording of it. So when you're like, why did they screw it up? You can go listen to yourself or read your own instructions and go, because I'm guilty of it. I'm like, I thought I was perfectly clear. And the company's like, oh, you said this. So I go back and,
I missed a step or I missed 10 steps. It happens. It just does. Yeah. And the second thing I was just going to say is, you know, in business, you need a competitive advantage. And I don't, this is not ugly by any means, but the reality is if you can pay one person $50,000 a year to do a job, or you can pay somebody, you know, $10,000 a year to do a job, and they both are the same job and the quality is there, your competitive advantage is gigantic. So you have to think of it that way, because other companies who you're competing with are doing the same thing. And if they're not, you're going to kick their ass.
Yeah. It also does this too. Like, let's say you find somebody that says they'll work for $7 an hour, $8 an hour, something like that. And they turn out to just be freaking phenomenal. Like, they're just like, you're like, I can't believe that I found, I'm so good. Give the freaking person a raise to $10 an hour and you're God, right? Yeah, like, you're like,
for sure.
They're going to stick with you. They're going to work with you. Like, especially when they didn't ask. You're just like, you know, you've been here 90 days. You're doing better than I could have expected. I'm going to bump you up $2 an hour. Like that person.
And they appreciate it. And it means a lot over there. It really does.
25% raise on an $8 employee.
Yep, for sure.
Right? I mean, like, when's the last time you got a 25% raise? Unless, like, you or me, we gave it to ourselves. But, like, as an employee, you go ask your employer for a 25% raise, you better be getting promoted into a new position or that ain't happening.
No way. No way.
You know? And I'm not even saying they should, because as a business owner, there's a point where, like, I would love to pay you that much. I can't. You're not worth that much. I'm sorry. But somebody that's going to do the job that I would pay $18 an hour for here and probably not do it as well, paying them 10, I can.
And it's interesting that the dynamic of people over there, they care and they really want to do a good job. And it's crazy trying to hire somebody over in the States for people who don't want to work versus for people who do want to work somewhere else. The dynamic is very different. It's
also tariff neutral, right? They can put all the tariffs they want on it, but there's no tariff on that, right? It's the labor. There's nothing shipped. Now, I was going to hit you on that just real quick. Is this going to hit you in the dick? All these tariffs?
Like I said, we do import some stuff from Italy. We bring some stuff in from Turkey and places like that. But the reality is, it is going to hurt temporarily, but I don't think it'll be long term. And the reality is we're playing it safe and, you know, we're adjusting prices as needed. And, you know, it's not a permanent thing, but we're trying to be flexible. And that's what business is all about, is being flexible.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And we got a question on the job site, so I'm going to bring that back up real quick. Christopher says, what website do you recommend to find virtual assistant? And it's onlinejobs.ph for the Philippines is the one that he's using. And if I needed somebody, I'd be digging into that thing as soon as we're done. Can you also talk about this? Like, one of the things I saw in your notes is it's not always the best idea to reinvest in your business versus paying yourself cash out of your business. Because you always hear people like that. For the first 2 years, man, don't take any money out of your business. Reinvest it. I have flaws that I see in that advice, and it's usually from people that didn't do it and don't have a business, but they have a TikTok channel or some shit like that. But why do you say that?
Yeah, so I think it's important to remember is, you know, I hate to say it this way, but, you know, your business could fold tomorrow, as an example. You know, for unknown reasons, you know, the market changes. I mean, crazy enough, like, you know, if you were bringing certain things in from certain countries right now, and you're getting an 86% tariff on, you know, your goods, that would be a really hard time to absorb, you know, and that would suck. So, you know, anything can happen in the market. You could have a new competitor come in. You could have all kinds of stuff. And the reality is, you know, if you're not paying yourself an adequate wage and all of a sudden your business is gone tomorrow, all of that work you've done for the last year, 2 years, a decade, you've got nothing out of it now. Unfortunately, you know, you could have been paying yourself, you know, whatever, $50,000 a year or whatever, and at least you have some amount of assets that came out of the business. But if you continuously reinvest, you know, at the end of it, you could be left with nothing. And it's a really sad state because it does happen and people's businesses do fold. And it's not a good move. I don't think it's a good move. I think you have to pay yourself a fair wage, and, you know, you try and reinvest some amount into the business. And finding that balance is hard, but, you know, just to have your business taken away and have nothing to show for it after hours and hours and hours of work, you know, decades even,
yeah,
that would be brutal. I couldn't even imagine that.
You know, remember the old saying from one of the Star Wars, like the newer movies, was only the Sith deal in absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
I would say only the Sith, the stupid, and the broke deal in absolutes. And here's what I mean. Like, if you tell me I should reinvest all my money in my business, okay, well, that you're putting me in the position that I was in when I was a motor sergeant in the Army, where the commander calls me at the end of the year and goes, you have to spend all the money, because if you don't spend all the money, we don't get the money next year. Except the difference is there is no money coming next year because I spent all the money. So you're saying I'm supposed to reinvest all the money, but what if there's not a good way to reinvest that money to build the business right now? What if I'm just buying magazine advertisements or something that aren't actually going to pay off, or I'm hiring more people than I need because I have surplus cash flow, so I think I'm growing the business, I'm growing headcount. That's not growing business. Unless you're growing revenue, you're not growing business. You're growing the number of people that depend on you to feed them. So if you say that I'm supposed to reinvest all my money, you're assuming that there is a way to capitalize on that capital right now into the business. There may not be. When I broke with my partners, my primary partner, Neil, he came to me about 6 months into it. Goes, I guess you really are blowing this up. Okay, this looks really good. I've been following what you're doing. Like, okay, great. And, you know, then he's like, I want us to work together again. I'm like, yeah, okay, what do you mean? He wanted to give me money.
Oh, okay.
To become an investor in TSP. And I'm like, I don't need your money.
Yeah, you don't want to be him be in control either.
I didn't want to invite that back in because we got along well and all, but he was very much a controlling partner. And I'm like, well, in this, you're going to be miserable, first of all, because there's no way you're going to get a controlling interest, right? Like you might get 10% of the – well, I'm up for that. No, because I know you. And I know that's not going to work for you. And you're going to want to start telling me how to do things. But the other thing is I don't have a place for your money to go. Like, I don't need a big marketing budget. I don't need a bunch of equipment. There's nothing for me to spend that money on. There's ways I could spend it, but there's nothing I'm going to spend it on. All of a sudden, my revenue is going to go up, right? And I don't want to build a business that scales that way. Like, I've done that already. I took my money out of those businesses, and I'm happy.
Yeah.
And I'm doing this for myself. And so I don't have a place for that money to go. Well, it could be just as easy that, like, you built this business and, like, okay, reinvest your money and you made $500,000 this year. And you've got $500,000 in capital. Well, maybe you don't have a place for it to go that makes sense. Well, then it needs to go in some sort of other investment. So the way I look at it this way is my money I first invest in my own business because I should be able to get a better ROI out of my business than I can buying stocks or bonds or something like that. Sure. But then once that business is optimized from an investment, like the cash flow back in is there, now I need to think about what do I do with that surplus capital? And that surplus capital might go buy me something I want. It might go in my bank account. It might go into Bitcoin. It might go into my retirement account. But I'm not leaving into the business just to have it sit there and eroded by inflation.
Yeah.
And a lot of big companies, it's exactly what they're doing. They're sitting on war chests of $30 billion. And that means that they're getting hammered for about, you know, $30 billion, you're getting hammered for about $800 million a year in loss.
Yeah, you got to pay taxes on it.
And you got to pay taxes on it while it sits there and you lose money on it. Yay!
Like, I would recommend anybody who's at the stage of business where they feel like they might need that, there's a fantastic book called Profit First.
Okay.
Kind of helps you, you know, divide out, you know, if you have, you know, every $100, you're going to, you know, X amount goes to, you know, operating expenses, X amount goes to profit, X amount goes to owner pay. And that was a gigantic leap forward for me because I was able to clearly see, you know, okay, well, I need to allocate, you know, whatever, 70% of every dollar to operating expenses or whatever.
Yeah.
And I could always tell, okay, well, I have this much money left over for me. And
yeah.
I know. And it was really helpful.
Just based on what you're doing, I bet you've watched an episode or two of Shark Tank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So have you ever noticed that, you know, maybe 1 in 10 of these people, when they come in, they'll pitch their business. They do a good job pitching their business. And they say they make a reasonable valuation and they ask for a reasonable amount of money for like a 25% stake in the business. But then one of the sharks will say, and if we give you this $250,000 or whatever, what are you going to do with it? And they just like they kind of go into like Mitch McConnell mode. They just kind of walk up for about
they just
10
pause.
Seconds.
They have no idea.
They never really thought about what they would do with, like, some are like, well, I got a PO in right now and I need to invest in moldings or whatever. Like, oh, okay, yeah, that's a good answer, right?
Mm-hmm. You know,
but like, we're going to do more marketing. Well, what kind of marketing, where and how, and how have you been?
Is it,
they don't
is it
have
pay?
A fucking idea what they would do with the money. Right. And that's when people say reinvest all of it. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, are you doing the same thing that that person on Shark Tank is doing? Like, you're investing it in your business, but you don't know what you're going to do with it. You don't know what. And what is, if you do this thing, what does success look like?
For sure.
Like,
for
if you've made this advertisement in the journal or whatever, and it was 100% successful, whatever that means to you, what does it mean? What, like, and if you don't know the answer to that, don't, it's the old investing thing, like, don't buy an investment you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Don't invest in marketing you don't understand.
Yeah, unless you can see a direct payback or you know for sure that a previous channel's worked, you don't want to dump more money into it just to dump it. I mean, if you're, you know, if you have profit and you want to test a new channel, you know, all that stuff, absolutely, for sure.
And that's the small portions thereof that you do testing with. And when that channel works, basically what I do, I find a channel that works, I start turning the volume up on it, so to speak, by spending more money on it. And when you get to that diminishing return point, you back the channel, you back the volume up about 10%, and you stay there.
Yep, and then you try to optimize. You try to bring costs down if you can.
Yep.
That's what we do with our Google Ads. Yeah, we're trying and, you know, experimenting and doing stuff all the time.
So let's hit kind of now the eventual goal of most people that go into this is eventually, I don't want to work for anybody else anymore. I want to work for myself. How do you make the determination of when it's time? Because it sounds like you may have put this application in before you made the final determination from what you said earlier to be on the show. So, like, this seems fairly recent that you've made this determination that you're going to go off on your own.
Yeah, it was pretty recent, but recent being this was, I actually put my notice in February. So I gave them a long time horizon. Again, they've been a great company to work for, and I didn't want to leave them empty handed and, you know, screwed, which I don't think that's right, especially for an employer that treats you right.
Yep.
If it was any other normal, you know, ABC employer who, you know, treats you like shit and, you know, they don't treat you good. I mean, whatever, 2 weeks and you're out.
2 weeks and out, yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, it really became the point where we had, and honestly, I, to be transparent, I don't make as much from my business as I do from what was my W-2 job. I'm pretty close.
Yeah.
The reality is I have time freedom. I have, you know, some money freedom because obviously having a business entitles you to all of the other slew of benefits for, you know, going out to eat and all the tax things that you talk about, and everybody can, you know, go back and listen to all that stuff. But it just came to be that, you know, I felt like it was finally at the stage where we had consistent revenue. And a big thing that I noticed this year was our ads had really, really hit the point where we're bringing in new customers at a consistent level. And I didn't need to handhold every single one of them to get through the checkout process. So they just went online, they bought, they checked out. And that to me was a gigantic move in scale. And I can see, all right, great. We have customers coming in. I don't necessarily have to, you know, white glove it, so to say, through every sales process. And we're consistently getting return orders from people who are repairing equipment. And we've just hit that inertia, and it takes time to build that. You know, anybody who's built a business, normally it takes a few years. You know, you have to, if you start a business from scratch, you know, the first 2-3 years, nobody knows you in the industry. They've never heard about you. They don't even, they don't exist as far as they're concerned, but you know, there is a certain amount of lag to get found in the marketplace and then for people to come back. And we're finally getting that. And that's where every customer that we've bought before that we've talked about that lifetime value, you know, they may have bought a year or two ago, but now they're buying again. And that's that, that inertia wheel that just keeps powering on and on and spins us forward.
You know, and the thing about your industry is people talk to each other. So that word of mouth builds up where people wouldn't think it would with, you know, because let me tell you, when I was in that space, like you talk to other companies, like you get a job and there's a piece of it that's bigger than your company is, or, you know, you get a job and it needs a rock saw. And I don't do that because I don't believe in buying equipment that I intentionally destroy. But, but you know, my buddy Bill has a company and they have a rock saw, and maybe I bring him in to take that one piece of the job and run 1,000 miles of rock, or 1,000 yards of rock trench for me, because I don't want to do it. And so when you have those relationships, you start talking to each other. The damn thing broke. Well, I got a new part. Where'd you get it? Like, that will be a conversation.
Yeah,
oh, those guys are great, man. They call you back. They fill the order. They give you a lead time. They meet their lead time. Like, oh shit. Get, like, I want to know that supplier if I'm in that space.
Yep.
And most businesses are like that. If you're selling beat and you see your, the other thing you've done, which is really great if you can do it, is be in a B2B space.
Yeah, for sure.
When you're in a B2B space, you're dealing with the customer by the very nature of that expects to pay a reasonable price for what they're buying. They expect service, and they're more concerned with getting the thing they need so they can stay in the business of generating revenue than, oh, I can get it for 5% less from somebody else.
Yep.
Right.
For sure.
Like if it was in the cabling space, you know, if it was a parts thing and, you know, like if Anixter was 5% less than Graybar and the job's 3 months out, I'm going to go cheaper. But if I'm working now and I need it now, then I want the person that can deliver with the least friction. Because the friction's more expensive than the product, right? I mean, that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, downtime's expensive in our industry. I mean, that translates to all kinds of other industries, too, though, not just downtime.
Oh, here's an interesting little tidbit. Trump paused all the tariffs except China again, and that's from Matt. And if it's from him, it's legit. Right.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I mean, it'll change again tomorrow, but at least that's good.
Yeah. What's probably happened is, you know, he said everybody's kissing his ass, and they probably are like, I think we're going to cut a deal with all these people. So we'll just pause it so they know it's still there. It's still over their head. Mm-hmm. And China's like, we fight to the end. Okay. All right.
No, the crazy orange man will change his mind 3 more times. So I'm not getting invested one way or the other.
No, don't. No. I think one of the plays that China has that people don't realize is the same play they've always done. They would have to do it again. And that is they can devalue their currency to the point where the tariff matters less to them.
Agreed.
And
agreed.
That is
right.
Probably what they're going to do. If you look, the yuan is already tanking.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's
and
taking
not
that as a victory. It may be completely intentional by the Chinese central bank.
Yeah, and with them not resupporting it this year, there is a real chance of that.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing, because by devaluing their currency, like if you want to be an export business, then you want your currency weak. When you have a strong currency, the export business sucks. When you have a weak currency, the export, that's why you can hire somebody in the Philippines for $8 an hour with a friggin' bachelor's degree.
Yep.
Because their $8 to them is worth, let's say, $30 here. In their economy with relative currency strength. And that's an arbitrage. That's what you're doing, is you're using geographic arbitrage for labor.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
If you're not building something, doesn't matter where they are. Like literally somebody could work for you on the moon if they had an internet connection.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe where we were, they have a 6-second latency delay.
So. Coming from the moon or from Mars.
I think that's about what it is. I think the moon and back is about a six second latency. It's a three up,
wow,
and three down. Yeah. Yeah, Mars is like 15 fucking minutes or something like that. It's
damn.
It's I think it's 8. I think it's 8, but that makes 16 round trip.
That's right? Crazy.
That's kind of crazy. I don't exactly, somebody in the live stream will probably use ChatGPT and tell us what the real number is, cuz 8 is the sun. So maybe I'm wrong, but it's minutes, it's not seconds. That'll be interesting. That'll be interesting, you know. If humanity actually makes it that far before we blow ourselves up.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, our boy Elon, he might get us there.
Yeah. So when are you taking that final leap? I know you said you gave him notice and all. When are you a free man?
Yeah, I'm a month out. So I can finally see the light at the end of the tunnel.
So you gave them about a quarter of notice. Mm-hmm. That says something about your commitment to them. I get that, because when I wanted to leave, I went to Neil and I told him I wanted to leave, and he basically said, will you give me 6 months and fix this thing for me? And I'm like,
yeah.
So I had to go home and tell my wife, give me 6 more months. That was not a fun conversation. I'm glad I did it in the end, right? Because then I walked clean, you know.
Well, and, you know, you build a network, and your network remembers, you know. And the people above and the people that I worked for, I wanted to stay in their good graces for sure. So
what are your final words of advice for people that are not in the position you are in, or even the position you've been in for several years of being one foot in both worlds, but they're thinking, I want something more. I want to become an entrepreneur. I want all the good things that come from that, but they're just not sure where to start. Like, how do they find their place? How do they formulate at least the beginnings of a plan and take that into action?
Yeah, if you wanted to mimic what I did, you know, go back to my suggestions and kind of use those as a good guidepost. If you wanted to start any other business, I think where people really screw themselves is they get they get, 3 feet from gold and then they stop trying. You know, they've done a business for 2-3 years and they just haven't seen the repeatable revenue. They haven't seen income. They haven't seen all that stuff. And then they jump to something else and they say, oh, that isn't working. And they just, they didn't give it quite the amount of time they needed. And this takes time. Honestly, if I were to show you my revenue numbers from the first 3 years, you could make the argument that maybe I shouldn't have done it as long as I did. And I think that's why entrepreneurs are a little crazier than most people, is because you're willing to work without a guaranteed payback. Yep. And the reality is that some people just they're not built that way. And I get it, I honestly, at times I've wondered if I was, but I think you have to stick with something, a solid business model, whether you're selling, beef from your cows that you raise on the homestead, or whether you make a product or whether you resell another product. It takes time. The momentum takes time to build. And I would just recommend that people don't jump ship before they really give it enough time to actually succeed for them.
Awesome, man. Awesome. And normally this is where I ask people to give their website out and all, but we're not doing that because you're still in this two world situation. But I bet you there's people in this audience that work on or work with or own companies that have heavy equipment. So maybe the way we can handle that, would say if somebody has need of a good parts supplier, they can email me and I'll forward it to you. Does that work?
That's fantastic, Jack. I appreciate the offer.
Yeah, yeah. And when you are completely free and clear, let us know and we can tell everybody the big mystery.
Absolutely. I'd love that.
Where they can go and do business with you, because there was at least one person that said they were sitting on the back of an excavator while they were listening to them.
I saw that.
So if there's one in the live stream, which was, it sucks that our live stream was impacted. We don't have as many people now at the end as we did when we lost the beginning because they didn't find their way back in or anything. But
yeah,
I'll get it all. The people that are on audio don't even know what happened really. But I'll get that all edited back together. But hey, I appreciate you being with us today.
No, it was a great time, man. This was, I told my fiance, I've listened to Jack for all these years and he's been a big mentor to me for, 10 years from back in the Jetta days. And, it's really, really exciting to come full circle and to be on the show and to actually show the work. So it's great. It's been great.
So I don't know if this was a person from earlier, but we got somebody right now, Jesse, saying he's on a D5 right now.
Yeah, so. I think that was him. Yep.
Okay. Well, if we had two, we really got some. Anyway, Nate, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
All right, folks, with that, we have wrapped things up. I want to remind you, one of the ways you can help support this show and the work that we do is do your online shopping where? tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And no matter what you buy, you will help us out as long as you start your shopping there. I got a good one for you. I have not brought this product around in about 6 months. It's the Frigidaire Portable Ice Maker. I think everybody should have one of these. I've got multiples because it really helps us down during events and workshops and stuff with extra ice. But, it's very low electrical draw, so really easy to make ice with your generator during a power outage. And it's just a huge convenient thing. We keep one of them running all the time in our pantry, and it's fantastic, and it's fast. They're really a great deal. They normally sell for about $100 to $110. When they go on sale, they get down into like the $80 to $90 range. Right now, the kind of the best looking one out of the group is the black stainless, in my opinion. It's on sale for $84. That's a hell of a deal. But the stainless steel model, if you don't mind stainless steel with its smudges, is on sale for $56. An ice machine, a portable ice machine, for $56, and it'll drop a rack of ice about once every 9 minutes once it starts running. The first cycle takes about 10 or 11, and then it's like clockwork, 9 minutes. Easy as pie. There's no installation. You just basically fill water into the reservoir with a jug, and you turn it on, and it makes ice. And it uses a pretty cool method. Like, it basically is recirculating the water with a pump, and they freeze onto these little pins, and then they're pushed off the pins, and that's why it's so fast. $56. I don't know what else to say. I have three ice machines plus a Vavor ice machine. Three of these plus one Vavor. $56. I like jack it on in another one. I was like, maybe I should buy an extra one. So check these out. This is a prepper item. It is a lifestyle item. It is a convenience item. It's an emergency medical item because ice is important for medical emergencies. And again, this uses so little energy, it can run on a friggin' 800-watt inverter off your vehicle. So it is a fantastic tool for the prepper and a good, you know, like it's the perfect item for a prepper because it's great in an emergency, but it's also something you can use every day. And at $56, what a hell of a deal if you will accept that one particular color that's marked down. And just real quick before I wrap up, that meter block smart thermometer setup, that's still on the deal of the day thing. They still have that on a limited time deal. At $156, that is a hell of a deal. That thing sells for $240 every day and people buy it. So if you are interested in picking one of those up, if it's been on your radar, now would be a good time to do it. Jesse says, what type of ice? I don't know, ice. It makes ice cubes about the size of a standard ice cube with a hole in the middle like a donut. It's not the pellet ice. That's the Vivor machine that makes the little pellet ice like you get at a convenience store. Anyway, with that, I am going to wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. I will catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, and sorry for the technical problems that we had. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.